Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to The Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to The Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with an award-winning engineer, director, and author. We get to talk with Charles Dye. We'll talk to him about what it was like mixing Livin' La Vida Loca, his views on the use of creative license, and we'll take a deep dive into his time working with Desmond Child. Now, I've known Charles for years now. He even wrote the back cover of my book, Mixing A to Z, and I can't wait to talk to him tonight. So if you'd like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. Charles, sir, how are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled.
Sir, it is my pleasure. I am glad you are here, and I would like to just jump in and take advantage of all the time that we do have. So let's start with your music career and work our way through it. I know you have the distinct pleasure of being the first engineer to record, mix a song 100% within Pro Tools. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. The reputation that you're referring to is, first of all, it's for the song Livin' La Vida Loca. And the accolade that people give to it is being the first song recorded and mixed entirely in the box that went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. Now, and this is 1999, there weren't a lot of records being recorded in Pro Tools at that time. Everybody was mixing on a console. Sometimes it was a digital console, sometimes it was an analog console. Nobody was mixing inside Pro Tools. And so when Livin' La Vida Loca came out and it had success, that's kind of what led to people pointing to it. It was produced by Desmond Child and Robbie Draco Rosa. I was one of many recording engineers on there, and then I was the mixing engineer. But what happened when it became popular, Billboard Magazine, people probably don't know this, but Billboard Magazine calls you up 2 weeks in advance when your song goes number one. The reason why it's 2 weeks in advance, because they're seeing all of the data coming in, and they've already got one chart out and they're preparing the next chart. By the time they know you're going to be number one, it's two charts away. So the minute you're going to go number one, the label gets called and the manager for the artist gets called, because there's all sorts of prep that they would like to be able to do. And Billboard is working with these people anyway to help artists, you know, advance their careers. So I was not in either of the rooms when the phone call came in from Billboard Magazine, but it filtered down to us, Desmond Child, who I was his studio manager at the time, and it came to the studio. We found out that it was going to be number one in 2 weeks, and we were like, wait, how did they even know? Like, we didn't know. Like, no, that's how it works. Like, oh, wow, okay, 2 weeks from now. Wow, okay, cool. And there's this chart that Billboard still has to this day where it's a four-column chart. It has all the big charts. So it says Hot 100 and R&B and country and hip hop. And then it's the number one song on each of those charts. And it's a tech chart. It's all about technology. And it's four columns. The first two columns are devoted to the console and tape machine that was used to record the song. And the second two columns are the columns that are devoted to the mixing console and mix down format. So of course it would say things like SSL and Atari. And then it would say Neve and, you know, maybe the mix down to Sony DAT. So it was basically the manufacturers, it was a props to the manufacturers for being involved in a number one hit. And the way they collect that information is a part of this process. So you're told that you're going to be number one in 2 weeks, and then they reach out and they speak to the engineers and producers that worked on the project, and they say, so what did you, you know, use for blank and blank and blank? So I got the phone call, and I'm talking to the person from Billboard that always collects this data every week. And he explained the little chart to me. I go, oh yeah, I know that chart. I've seen it before. And he says, yeah. So he says, what was the tape machine that you used to record Living La Vida Loca? I said, we used Pro Tools actually. And he said, what was the console? And I said, it was Pro Tools. Oh, like he's never ever collected this data before. And they said, okay, well, what was your mixing console? And I said, Pro Tools. So he said, what was your mix down format? What did you print the mix to? I said, Pro Tools. And he went, he says to me, he's exclaiming out loud to me, like it's a reaction. He's like, that's never happened before that one manufacturer was in L4 categories. That's crazy. So I call up Avid, which was at the time called DigiDesign, and I say, hey, do you know if anybody's released a song that's been entirely recorded and mixed in Pro Tools that's gone to number one? And I'm speaking to the marketing people, and they're saying, well, yeah, I think so. I think maybe Butch Vig did that with Garbage. I said, no, I read all those articles. They Analog Console, and they definitely printed analog. I know they recorded in Pro Tools. They were big about that, but no, they didn't. They didn't mix in Pro Tools. I said, well, maybe Thomas Dolby. I know, read those articles too. So they rattle off a few. I don't think any of the people you're mentioning have. And they said, they then said back to me, I don't know then if anything has ever gone to number one that's been recorded and mixed entirely Pro Tools. And I said, surprise. Well, you have now. Yeah. So they found out 2 weeks in advance also that they were going to, and I told them the story about the chart, that they were going to be featured in all the categories. And that's what Avid used to encourage others. Like they did a big press release and did all sorts of promotion about it. Like, I know that you guys are all busy recording in your $500,000 control rooms, but these guys are over here on a, I don't know, I'm guessing $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 Pro Tools rig, and they recorded and mixed it entirely all in the box. So maybe you should at least consider recording into Pro Tools, was I guess their argument. And obviously 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years later, eventually everybody else was doing something rather similar.
I mean, that's amazing to begin with that you're involved in it. Yeah. But being the first, what's that feel like to you? What's going through your mind at that time?
I was thrilled. I was one of many recording engineers, so I did not do all the recording. The three other engineers were Craig Loswick, Nathan Malky, and Jules Gondar. And the four of us recorded it together. I was the mixing engineer. But to answer your question, you know, it feels sort of validating because you're going against the flow of what everybody else is expecting you to do. And that's just my nature. I'm like that. I was doing project studio work early. I started to realize, as many, many, many other engineers did in the mid to early 90s, as we looked around, we're in a $1 million control room where we're using a very nice mic that cost $2,000 and we're using a very nice mic pre that cost, you know, maybe also $2,000. And we're not using anything else in the whole room. We're just using $4,000 of equipment. The room, and when I say $500,000, allow me to quantify, the console, the SSL, $250,000. The tape machine, the Sony 3348 that we were all using at the time, another $250,000. So just two pieces of equipment were $500,000. By the time you threw in the architecture and all the outboard gear with, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, $10,000+ reverbs, et cetera, we were generally, like, it wasn't hyperbole to say we were in a $1 million control room. But I would look around and go, I'm using $4,000 of equipment. I mean, yes, I'm using the faders on the console to monitor, but I'm not using the console. And yes, I happen to be using the tape machine, but it's a digital tape machine in the days of the D88 and ADATs. The D88 and the ADATs were doing something really similar. So I just got onto the project studio train in the beginning. And then when the opportunity came up, when Desmond Child interviewed me to be his engineer, I don't get credit for the idea of Pro Tools, of using Pro Tools to make records. He was the person who had a Pro Tools studio already installed. David Frangione had installed the studio for him. He had a really nice Pro Tools studio, and it was Desmond's vision to record these records that way. So I'd already worked in project studios, so I was very comfortable in the project studio approach, and I'd already worked on hard disk. I've been working on the Sonic Solutions hard disk system, which at the time wasn't called a DAW, but kind of was becoming, that was the word that was coming into norm. And the New England Digital Synclavier and Post Pro, which was a 16-track hard disk recording system. And I was comfortable in hard disk, but Pro Tools kind of brought it to a whole new level of comfort. It was multi-track. At the time, we had 32 tracks, and it worked in bars and beats. At this point, I'm speaking to the choir completely, obviously, but at the time that was revolutionary and it really made a difference for us. So he, Desmond, had the vision of, I'm going to record all my vocals in here. Desmond is probably the best vocal producer I've ever worked with. And he just had this vision for comping vocals. Like he could hear a finished vocal when he was writing the lyric, and he would guide the singer to give him all of those parts and performances. And then he would go and comp it together. And he had been exposed to Pro Tools, I think, from David Frangione and Aerosmith. And he realized, I've got to have this. This will allow me to make the perfect vocal comp. And he was right. And so Desmond said, look, I want to use Pro Tools for all my recording. Are you okay with that? And I said, yeah, I'm really comfortable on that. So that's kind of how that all got started. Was Desmond in 1996 hired me. And then 3 years later, in that very studio, we ended up recording Living La Vida Loca and about half the rest of that album.
That's awesome. Once you do that, or once you, you know, get the credit for doing this, do you find that more people are coming to you to do the same for them? Like it's some sort of magic box at that point?
Well, I mean, my big break wasn't Living La Vida Loca. It was instantly before that. It was a situation like that. It's the same year. It's 1999, and it's about a couple months before. When I tell the story now, it's people would not be thinking the way that this story unfolded, but that's how it was. So Sammy Hagar was my first big break as a mixer. Like the first record that I ever mixed, I was a frustrated, you know, like frustrated air drummers, like frustrated drummers. I'm kind of that too. So I'm not a real drummer, but I'm a frustrated drummer. I tried to learn drums when I was younger. So I was also a frustrated mixer. I had actually resigned myself to being a recording engineer, and that I wanted desperately to be a mixing engineer. And it was just clear I didn't have it, it seemed. Seemed obvious to me that I didn't have it. So, and in part because it kept being proven to me that I didn't have it, I would be the recording engineer on a record. And I so really wanted to be the mixing engineer. And then it got mixed and it wasn't me sitting behind the console doing it. When the mixes came back from these different engineers, you know, Chuck Hanley or Mick Kazowski or Bob Clearmountain, they would sound like God and I would be blown away. I'm like, I don't know how to do that. So, you know, I got it. Okay, I'm a blue collar engineer. I'm going to be a recording engineer. So to answer your story, your question about people coming to me, I am comfortable in Pro Tools at this point in 1996, 7, and 8. So I'm really comfortable in Pro Tools. The sales rep from Mackie, who was helping us at our studio in Miami, he was all over the country. And he was also out in LA, or maybe even Bay Area. So Sammy Hagar was making his first solo record post Van Halen, and he is choosing to record his whole record in Pro Tools. He's built his own studio in his basement. He's for the first time producing his own record. He's never produced his own records before. And I'm saying all this like I was there. I had nothing to do with this. This was nothing, you know, I didn't know anything about this until I heard about it all after the fact. So, but all of this is happening kind of in parallel with me working in Miami with Desmond, the album that is called Ricky Martin, but has Living La Vida Loca on it. And the rep from Mackie, he says, you know, Charles, I was talking to Sammy Hagar and he asked me if I know anybody that works on Pro Tools. And I gave him your name. I said, oh, that's cool. I said, thank you. Thank you very much for that. And then he says this sentence to me. This is the one I'm talking about that would be like, nobody would do that today. Sammy says, this is the Mackie guy, David, telling me this. Sammy says he recorded the whole record in Pro Tools and he really wants to keep it in Pro Tools to do the mix. Now, that's really antithetical to even the way people thought in the 90s. Like, I'm going to record in Pro Tools, and I'm going to go to an analog console mix. I'm going to print it down to analog tape. Like, that would be like the whole thinking. But this was Sammy Hagar being the producer. He's his own producer. And for whatever reason, lucky me, he was like, nope, I don't want to leave this box of Pro Tools. So I'm really comfortable with Pro Tools. I'm not a mixing engineer of any note. I'm a mixing engineer of no note. I've mixed a few records, but none of them were big songs. And I don't think any of those mixes were particularly good. But this opportunity was at my doorstep. And obviously, I'm not going to blow this opportunity. So Sammy asked me to mix his tracks. And he sends me his Pro Tools session. This is before Living La Vida Loca. But it's at the same studio. I'm doing the mixing at Desmond's studio. So he sends me the tracks, the Pro Tools session. And I do the mix. And this mix... this is a mix that's coming back on speakers that I've just completed in Pro Tools I did it, by the way, together with a really close friend of mine named Tom McWilliams. Tom and I did the song together. He's a producer. And so Tom added some cool loops in there. And like the decision-making process of, you know, is this working? Is this working? And we're both credited as mixers on it, goes to both of us. So I don't want to leave Tom's name out. So Tom McWilliams and I are doing this mix, but I'm listening back to it. And it's the first time I've ever experienced a mix where I went, wow, that's... like I'm tilting my head. I was, that sounds like a record. Wow. I thought I didn't know how to do this. I didn't think I could do this. So I'm feeling kind of both frustrated and confident. Like I've done this, but since I know that I can't do this, was this an accident? Did I like stumble once into a good mix and never be able to reproduce it again? Literally, that was going through my head. But Sammy Hagar, when he received the mix, he was in his car listening to it. And he was like describing this to me as, well, he was in his car driving down the road and he's listening to the mix and he describes it literally as a Maserati. I don't know if it was, but he describes it that way. And he pulled over and he literally had to call me right there. And dude, his voice was three octaves. It's like flipping out. He was just ecstatic. So that experience, though it's not somebody coming to me because of a reputation I have, because I didn't have yet any kind of a reputation, but because of the connection of my friend David, who made that introduction for me. Now, to answer your question, did that continue later? Sure, people came to me and asked me to mix their stuff, but it wasn't so much about Pro Tools. I definitely found myself again and again and again when name people would come to me and I would explain that I'm going to be mixing it in Pro Tools for at least the first 3 years. It was always like, why? Why are you going to do that? And I would just explain, well, it's what I'm comfortable in. It's my axe. Like I can craft and shape my sounds in here like I'm not capable of doing on analog consoles. But yeah, a few people have. But that story was one where it was literally the kind of the connection. And it was that experience of mixing those two songs that I ended up mixing together with my friend Tom McWilliams that we mixed for Sammy Hagar that Desmond listened to. And I guess in part that gave Desmond the confidence to ask me to mix Livin' La Vida Loca. Not to tell a long version of that story, but I wasn't supposed to mix Livin' La Vida Loca. Somebody else was. And they did the mix. And it was when that mix was finished that Desmond and Robbie turned to me and said, Charles, can you... they really liked my rough, but it wasn't a finished record. And Desmond at that point had heard my Sammy Hagar work. And they turned to me and they said, Charles, can you take your rough mix of Livin' La Vida Loca and spend some more time on it and just, you know, bring it alive? And since I knew that they were liking the sounds and they were trying to get the other mix, I'm not going to name the other mixing engineer, but they were trying to get the other mixing engineer to get their sounds closer to the sounds that I had been doing when I did my rough mix. So I popped open the session and I had a rough mix without a lot of automation. So all I did was spend a few more hours doing automation. And basically the mix that's on the record is my rough with automation.
Oh, nice.
So it was the sounds that I had done on the rough mix. And then I spent a number of hours just, you know, getting every little moment to kind of pop and explode.
You're talking about Sammy Hagar and now you're talking about Ricky Martin. But you mentioned sending him the mixes. So what was the process like for you? Do you send him the mixes? Does he critique them and then ask for changes? Or is it just you sent it and he accepted it?
With Sammy, it was, he loved it. He had some notes and we did tweaks to that for both of the mixes, Tom and I. They weren't big tweaks. They were smaller tweaks, but he had notes. He was overall happy. And then with Ricky, it was the artist, but he wasn't the producer. And Ricky was always very happy with the work that his producers were doing. Again, the producers were Desmond Child and Robbie Dracarosa. Robbie Dracarosa was a co-writer with Ricky on all the songs and a producer, generally shared production credit on all the songs on that record. And then Robbie would work together with other producers. And Desmond did about, I think that record has about 11 or 12 songs on it. And Desmond did about six of them, as I recall. And then the rest weren't all entirely Emilio's producers, Emilio Stefan's producers, but a number were. But Robbie was the producer in all. To answer your question, Desmond and Robbie both definitely gave me notes multiple times. And, you know, that was kind of our working method anyway, because Desmond was obviously comfortable with Pro Tools. We've been using it since 96, so for 3 years. Robbie had been working together with us. We worked on the record that had Livin' La Vida Loca on it for at least 18 months. So like half of that 3 year period was working on and off on that record. And Robbie was constantly coming to the studio and working with Desmond. And often the way that they worked is they wouldn't be in the room at the same time. They got along fine. That wasn't the issue. But Robbie would be off working on something and then he'd stop into the studio and he'd be off writing or programming or whatever. There were other studios set up. So he'd be working with Randy Barlow on programming tracks for other things or doing songwriting with Desmond or doing scratch vocals or whatever in other rooms. So Robbie would come into the room and he'd listen to where we were with whatever it was, a mix, et cetera. And he'd give me notes and I would do his notes. And then Desmond would come in and he would just hear the result of that work. Then he'd give me new notes. And then later Robbie would come in and they would in real time give me notes while we were working, which is my preferred way. But many clients I've been working with are asynchronous where you send them the file. They listen to it multiple times in different systems, cars and speakers and headphones. And then they come back with like a list of notes. And most mix adjustments I do these days are done that way, the asynchronous method.
So comparatively, how often are the artists actually in the studio with you?
Not often now. Generally, I'm not in the studio with the producers. When I work with George Noriega and Tim Mitchell, I'm often working together with them directly at George Noriega's Cutting Cane Studios. And then it's the whole old style, real time, you know, in the room with the producer. But a lot of the mixing that I do is actually done that asynchronous method these days. And sometimes clients aren't even in the same city, like they're in Europe or in LA or whatever. And I'm in Miami.
Right. Well, what's the most memorable moment you have from that time?
Wow. One of the more memorable mix experiences and one of my favorite records that I mixed was a record that I did for Alejandro Guzman. Tim Mitchell and George Noriega were the producers. It was a live production, sort of like an MTV Unplugged, but it wasn't Unplugged, but like that for Sony. And it was, I believe it was on MTV Latin America, as I recall. And the name is obviously in Spanish, but it meant something like live. Oh, Primera Fila. That was it. Primera Fila. So Primera Fila was this series. It was this series of concerts, pre-recorded concerts with artists that they had on, I believe, MTV Latin America. And Sony was her label and still is. So it's an entire show, but it's one of those where you're recording it. You're not doing the concert for the audience. The audience are invited in and it's literally their job to clap at the end, and they'll have to suffer through repeated performances if somebody makes a mistake or like, and they almost always do two or three takes. And then you edit together as if it was a seamless performance. But the mixing of that record, the mixing of that whole record, it was just one of my favorite mixing experiences. I felt it was some of my strongest work as a mixing engineer, and I'm proud of lots of my mixing work, but I don't want to say I'm proudest because it makes it seem like I'm not as proud for some of the other stuff. But anyway, that was a really memorable record to mix. Primera Fila record for Alejandro Guzman. Really enjoyed mixing that record.
Very cool. So how do you go from doing this work and transitioning into movies?
With difficulty. it's not a seamless and obvious transition. My original passion as a kid was films. And I got into the music industry almost by accident. I met some musicians that were recording a record. It was my first experience in a studio. I was 18 years old and I got kind of inspired by what they were doing. And then I ended up studying in college. You know, when you get excited for something when you're like a kid, like for example, the way I ended up playing clarinet was that my uncle came over to my house right before I was going to join the band in junior high and in middle school, and I was going to do drums. And then my uncle comes over and brings his clarinet and he serenades me the whole night and gets me all enthused about clarinet. Later, I never asked my dad, but I'm pretty clear my dad did not want a drum kit in the house. And he asked his brother to come over and convince me to pick clarinet. I'm like 1,000% certain of this, though I've never asked my father. But there's just no way the time, like the guy lived 4 hours away. Oh my God, look, Uncle Fred's here. Oh my gosh, he's with his clarinet. Oh my gosh, he's doing a little concert for me for hours on end. And I'm just getting all excited. Fred, I'm sure my dad said to his brother, whatever you do, when you finish playing for him, make sure he chooses clarinet tomorrow in the band. So anyway, I was all excited about music. It was right at the time that I enrolled in college. So I studied audio production and video production. And then the opportunity that hit me first, and I was sort of a little bit more focused on that in college, even though I studied video production, I got an internship at Criteria, the Hit Factory studio here down in South Florida. And I did the internship. And then from that internship, I was offered a job as an assistant engineer. So at that point, I was just sort of funneled into the path of the music industry. So when things started to slow down around 2008, when the industry was kind of at its lowest point, 2008, 9, and 10, that's when I said, you know, I'm going to try to put my foot in this filmmaking door. So I started working in post-production. I took a screenwriting class at UCLA and got really excited by the writing process. I'd already written, but it was all, you know, like I had written columns and tutorial videos and stuff. So I was confident in my ability to craft words, but I was not a storyteller. So I studied screenwriting at UCLA and wrote a script. That script eventually became the short film that I first did called Two Secrets. Have written other scripts since then. I was almost going to produce the second one. It was called Butterfly. It was also going to be a short film. And I was in pre-production. I was budgeting. I was doing storyboards. And I realized I don't want to make another film. I want to continue storytelling. But I had realized that when you finish the script, not that this is news to anybody, but when you finish the script, nobody reads the story except for filmmakers. In fact, scripts are almost opaque in their ability to be read by laymen. It just feels so unlike a story. It feels so like you're reading a technical document, which is literally what it is. But you can't share your story with family members or friends because you have to explain all the technical crap to them. And I was like, I have to mount, and I'd already done it with the first film. Like it was a semi-big budget short. It was a 20-minute film, but we spent about $50,000 on it, which is a very large budget for a short film. Most short films are a few thousand dollars, but we spent a lot of money and it looks good. It's a really great looking film and tons of talented people worked on it. And I'm very happy with the results, but it's the mounting of an army that is required to tell a story. And I was like, I don't want to mount an army to tell my stories. I would like to finish the writing and share the story. And that's novel writing. No news to anybody. And I'm like, I'm going to pursue that. So I have paused my filmmaking aspirations. I might go back to them, but I paused them and I'm now pursuing prose and fictional storytelling and novel writing. I'm currently enrolled at FIU, Florida International University, pursuing my creative writing MFA. And as a part of that program, your thesis year, which is your third year, is writing a novel. So I already have ideas for that novel, which I had shared with you, and doing a lot of writing on that novel, but just more right now on structure and working out the story. But that's kind of where my storytelling pursuits are. I'm happy with the film that I made, but I'm pausing filmmaking. But it's been an evolving process. Storytelling is something I have always been wanting to pursue, and that's what led me to film and is now leading me to pursuing novel writing.
We had Martin Lestraps on the show the other night. He's an author, and he was telling us about the art of storytelling. And I mean, it truly is an art. Mm. It's definitely something that most people don't consider or think about when they're watching movies or listening to songs. Even the song has a story. It's a short story within itself. Yeah,
exactly.
Did you find that time that you spent in the studio mixing songs translated into the world of making the movie?
Yes, but also backwards. Because I'm inherently a movie person more than a music person, because I'm not really a musician, clarinet and bad drumming, because I did end up taking drum lessons, don't count. I don't count myself as a true musician. I've worked with many, as I'm sure you have, and I'm not one of those magically touched people. But because I have this sort of movie brain, like I love films and have been, you know, I watch films constantly and have always since I was a kid. So yeah, similar to Martin Lestraps, I've always seen absolutely some songs are without a doubt stories. Taylor Swift and other writers are definitely storytelling writers. But I saw the process of mixing as making, like making a movie, like When I'm trying to craft the mix, what I'm really often working towards is making it feel unstatic. I don't want the first verse and the second verse to sound alike. Yes, they are similar melodies and potentially similar production, but usually not. Usually the production in the first verse is different. There are new instruments, new drum parts, etc. And if I were to just get my sounds and get a good balance on everything and print, I would end up with a mix that would sound generally well balanced and everything would have its place. But what it wouldn't do is feel alive. So I've always used my sort of mind of how a movie starts and then evolves and leads to a large climax in the third act. I've always approached mixing like that. Like I want the mix, the first chorus, even though it's super similar to the second chorus, I will do things to definitely contrast the two choruses. And I will do things on the third chorus to make the third chorus feel even bigger. Yeah, usually the vocals and the instrumentals will be doing that too. There'll be new instruments that are layered in on the second chorus and even more instruments layered in on the third chorus. But if they didn't, I will be doing that through my mixing. Like power guitars that are in every chorus, I will make them just a touch of energy under everything in that first chorus. And by the last chorus, they'll be just big and you'll go, oh man, where did those guitars come from? They've been here the whole time, but I'm not bringing them out until that last chorus. So my mind looked at that like I was telling a movie with a mix or with sound. And then the other way, I guess the craft of putting together and understanding that there are parts and elements, like the engineer in me, I look at storytelling like the OCD, anal retentive aspect of me that so many engineers share that attracts us to engineering. I apply that same thinking to storytelling. I'm not only trying to break storytelling down into the mechanical parts of it, but for me to understand the craft of it, I'm often trying to understand the mechanics of the components of the story, whether we're talking action or visuals or dialogue or filmmaking. But still, I use my engineering way of understanding things to learn storytelling and filmmaking.
Like you mentioned earlier, for yourself, for me, mixing was always the brass ring that I strive for. And I've kind of found that I combine mixing and editing together because I like to move things around and I like to create that story that you're referencing. So I didn't really think of them as two separate jobs. So I really enjoyed that. But I guess how much creative license do you take?
I don't limit myself. The way I look at it, just going back to what you were saying, the way I look at it is, when the producer delivers the track, this is what he believes he wants. But I learned really early on that if I literally do only what the producer asks me to do, I will often have a producer who is not completely satisfied with the results and they don't know why. But my goal is to, in the end, satisfy them. So I learned this a little early on. It's a lesson I learned with Desmond. Desmond often would work this way with me. He would play something for me and he goes, I want it to sound like that. So he plays me Ironic by Alanis Morissette. Glenn Ballard produced this. The verse is intentionally kind of, she's speaking quietly and like the instrumentation is like insanely sparse. I think it's maybe one or two instruments. And you generally, when the song starts, you turn up the volume because it's really quiet. And the chorus comes in on one with no sweep or anything. It's just like, bam! And it's like 10 dB louder and it explodes. And there's just like a gazillion instruments that all explode at once. An erotic downbeat. Everybody was shocked by that chorus. It doesn't stand out today as being, holy, that's crazy. But at the time, it was like, wow. So anyway, he would be like, I want the chorus to explode like that. I'm listening to the parts that he's given me and I didn't say this to him, but I'm like, I don't got it. Like what you're reacting to is there's some power guitars that are going, I'm not saying this to him. This is all up here. There's some power guitars that are coming. And I'm like, again, not saying any of this. I'm thinking to myself, I don't got the parts here. I have piano. It's acoustic piano. It's like clean. It's just chords, acoustic piano. And now this is way before all the distortion plugins, but I had a Digitech guitar processor. So I ran the piano again, clean acoustic piano. I ran, I'm sure you've heard, distorted piano at this point, because who can avoid sticking an amp plug-in over a piano just to hear what'll happen? And it sounded like power guitars. This is on Aerosmith, by the way. It sounded like power guitars. It sounded like, I was like, oh yeah. So he did not tell me, nor would he, if I would have asked him, yeah, you want me to take the piano and overdrive the shit out of it so it sounds like power guitars? Like, he would have, no, because he probably played the piano. I'd be like, no, it'll ruin the piano sound. I'm like, so I didn't ask him. I didn't tell him. I didn't even explain it. I just took the piano. I ran it through the distortion. It now sounded like power chords. And I added it in, kept the piano, but I added it in underneath, and I gave him what he wanted. I didn't do what he wanted. I didn't do the exact thing he asked for, but I gave him what he wanted. And that's when I learned the lesson. Don't give people what they're asking for. Don't literally listen to what they're asking for. Not to ignore it, but try to hear what they want. Like, hear between what they're asking for what they really want. And then if you can deliver it, do it. So ever since I learned that lesson with him, that was early on, that was earlier than Live in La Vida Loca, I've done that. And one story where I did it is on Live in La Vida Loca. The horns that are throughout the choruses of that song, none of them were played in the chorus of that song. None of them. They were played in this instrumental bridge section that's between the second chorus and the third chorus. It's like this bridge section of the song. There's lyrics in the section. I don't quite remember what's going on in that section, but I listened to it recently to remind myself where the horns were from. And it was from this bridge near the end before the last chorus. And there were spaces, and there was this sort of lacking energy in the choruses. And I loved the horns. They were played by Tony Concepcion. Brilliant job on the horns. And I was like, man. So I took those horns and everywhere else that you hear horns in Live in La Vida Loca were the horns that were played in the bridge. He played all these really cool riffs that I took, and I didn't cut them up a lot, but sometimes it would be a longer phrase and the whole phrase wouldn't work. So I would use just part of that phrase. And I put it in between the lead vocals throughout the chorus. And then once I did it in the first chorus, I just put it in every chorus. And I didn't explain it to Desmond. I wasn't trying to mislead him. But I learned the lesson from him that don't explain it, just do it. And he would literally say, his big saying was dare to suck. Like, he encouraged risk taking. So like, that was the ethos of Desmond Child's production company and his studio was take risks, dare to suck, do something that you think is terrible that I'm going to hate. Not his words. His words were dare to suck. But what he meant was do something that you're afraid to do that you think I'm going to hate, but I might love. So just do it. Don't tell me about it. Just do it. And then I'll just decide if I like it or not. So I put those horns in all the choruses and I played it for Desmond, and he didn't comment. He didn't like ask where did those horns come from or whatever. He liked it. And then I played it for Robbie later when I was doing all the other stuff. And to this day, I've always assumed that Desmond probably thought that Robbie had me put the horns in, and Robbie probably thought, because they were never in the room right at the same time, or almost never in the room at the same time. I mean, they wrote the song together, so they were obviously in the room together when they wrote it. But and that Robbie assumed that Desmond, like neither of them wondered where they came from, because they were often not in the room together giving me feedback. So that's another example of that. And I've always done that. On the Sammy Hagar track, same thing happened. We put a loop in there. Sammy didn't ask us to put a loop in there. And then that changed the vibe of the track. So it felt like a Southern revival. So we actually added vocals. We added, they're not a singer. It's Tom, my friend Tom McWilliams, doing like a Southern accent. And he's just reading straight out of the Bible. So we didn't write lyrics or anything, but he's just reading it like it's a sermon. And it was this instrumental section, and it just felt like it needed some vocal energy. So Tom had this idea, like, so he did this Southern preacher thing. And then we did, you know, we added distortion to it, and we just kind of tucked it in there for the energy of it. And then Sammy was like, I love it, but what's being said? Because I'm going to need to do it in the show. And we said, oh, I sent the Bible quote. And we sent him, like, you know, I'm sure we just sent him the quote. And then I don't know if he actually does it during his shows, but anyway, so absolutely. Yeah. I'm right there with you with the, I'll just do anything. Just the other day, I mixed a track for a producer, and there was this really cool part that I loved that I thought, you know, that the song should end with that. It was a vocal part. It was from the singer. It was like a, but it was a group vocals. I said, the song should end with that. But it had this really cool cold stop. But I thought right after the cold stop, if we just put that vocal there, that would be a really strong ending. So I put it there. Same thing. I didn't tell the producer. He's a really smart producer. So I'm sure he knew that I put it there and that it was a change, but it's on the record. So yes, I think now that we can make musical changes and adjustments, let's call them, fairly easily, if the producers like what comes back to them, they don't mind. I don't think rarely have I had a producer when I've made that type of tweak go, I mean, sure, sometimes they go, yeah, I don't really like that. I'm like, okay, cool. And I just mute it because I don't ever get married to my ideas. I'm presenting them to the producer as an idea. Like, what do you think? Like I don't say, hey, what do you think? But I present it to them with that sort of thought in mind. And if they like it, cool, it stays. And if they don't, I mute it and I don't go to bat for it.
No, I can see that. I've made a lot of changes that I don't even think some people recognize the changes you make sometimes. You know, you think, yeah. Oh, I just made this change. It's going to make the whole record. But most people don't even notice it. So it keeps the ego in check.
But we do. Right. We notice Makes it. Us we happy. Know it's there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've spent a lot of time working with Desmond, and just your comment there, the daring to suck. Did you find him to be a mentor to you?
Oh, without a doubt. I learned to mix from Desmond. He's not an engineer. So he didn't teach me to mix. But my personality type responds really well to demanding people. And Desmond is a demanding person, a really demanding person. And you know, he expects greatness from everybody that's working with him. And he pushes everybody to do their best possible work. So that works really well with my personality type. So he would often, again, this is, I'm essentially learning to mix, but I don't know that I'm learning to mix. Desmond is essentially teaching me to mix, but I'm unaware that that's what's happening. And his approach was this. His approach was, I want the piano to sound like this. So he would play me a song. The specific memory for the piano was, it was a Shania Twain track. And I'm listening to the piano, and it's an acoustic piano. And the piano that we're working on is an acoustic piano. And the shape of it, like the EQ curve on it, is kind of that typical rock, like super brassy and, you know, 2K and 4K and even maybe more boosted and like low mid scoop and then something in the 200 area to give it warmth. But like this scoop low mid thing, like their curve and my curve were really similar, like rock. Something else about their piano was like more. I was like, what are they? But it sounded like they'd stuck a harmonizer on it, like a split. You know, like 9 cents up, 9 cents down. It sounded like they had layered in a little bit of a chorus and a harmonizer to make the piano feel thicker and richer than just the acoustic piano. So I just emulated what I heard. And Desmond kept doing this with me. The other more, you know, memorable or equally memorable moment was he wasn't happy with a vocal sound. And I'm not doing it for a big name artist at the time. This is a new up and coming artist at the time, R&B artist. And Desmond's not liking the vocal sound. My vocal sound kind of came last, but it came through the same process from Desmond. And in this particular instance that I'm remembering, he played me a Mick Gazowski record. And I can't remember the artist. Might have been Whitney Houston or Mariah Carey. Mick mixed a lot of the Mariah Carey records. So really good possibility that it was Mariah Carey. And this was before I had my vocal sound together. So I wasn't even aware. Like nobody ever pushed me to like observe this before. So he plays me this Mick Gazowski mix, which his records are some of the biggest sounding records out there. He's the most successful mixing engineer in history. I mean, maybe his credit is challenged these days. But at the time he had mixed not only all of Mariah Carey's records, but so many other artists, and it was mainly from that Mariah Carey chunk that he had the more number ones and more successful records than almost anybody else at the time. Although Bob Clearmountain, I'm sure, challenges him if we were to like stack up all the sales. But anyway, the point I'm trying to say is Mick Gazowski's sound is this hit. Mick Gazowski is this amazing mixer, and his records just sound so big and so deep and so wide. He is such a craftsman. And the vocals on this particular track were just, they were gorgeous, but they just sort of sat like perfectly in the middle. And then there was so much space between them. And then they had this like element to their reverb that I was like, what the, that sounds amazing. What is that? And I'm really kind of like dissecting the reverb on her voice at that moment. I'm trying to figure out what I'm hearing, because I'm hearing a delay, but that's no delay like I would ever do a delay. At this point, it sounds so normal to me that it's kind of almost hard for me to imagine that at the time I didn't know to do this, but I was like, that's a delay, but that delay is so drenched in reverb, you're not hearing it as a delay, you're hearing it as sort of a rhythmical reverb. So Mariah would sing, and then there was, or it could have been Celine Dion, I don't remember which it was, but there would be some reverb right after she would sing, and then a space, and then this other sort of musical pello that kept coming in the back. And I just kept messing with my delay to get it. And it was essentially, the vocal had like a quarter note. It doesn't, the musicality of the delay was either eighth or quarter. That part wasn't important. But the part was that it had no top end. So all the top end had been taken off the delay. I learned later probably had some of its low end taken out, but I didn't add that in right away. But if you're trying to emulate this, so you take out like everything at least above 4K, but maybe everything above 2K. Feel free to take out everything below 100, but maybe even higher, 200 or more. So you have a delay that if you were to listen to it nakedly, it would sound very sort of clipped and small EQ-wise, but then it's buried in reverb. So what you really end up with is it just sounds like this rhythmical reverb. And then the level of it was pretty low. It was like blended in with the reverb. And so I just kept adding tools to my mixing tool belt, with Desmond pushing me to get each one of like these things sounding better, each instrument sounding better and better. So yeah, Desmond in many ways was my mixing mentor. He, by pushing me to make my mixes sound better, he sort of turned me into a mixing engineer, because I became a mixing engineer in those 3 years when I was working with him on those records.
So he challenged you.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, I was like,
bring it on.
What else do you want me to do? I'm all ears, Desmond.
That's awesome. Well, we do this segment here we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who might be working behind the scenes and not typically get credit. Do you have anybody you'd like to give a little credit to?
I mentioned them before, but I'm going to mention them again, and I'll tell the story. When Livin' La Vida Loca was successful, Dan Daly from Mix Magazine, he was doing a piece about the production of that song. So he interviewed Desmond, he interviewed me. And he asked me about the engineering on that record. And at the time, I told him that Craig Lozowick and Nathan Malky and Jules Gondar and myself, we all recorded it. We were all recording engineers working for Desmond. I was the chief engineer for Desmond's studio, but I was not the only engineer. So Craig and Nathan and Jules were working for me, but still, I wasn't in the room. Craig would record stuff. Nathan would record stuff, and Jules would record stuff. And they're credited on the record. Like, they are the credited recording engineers of Livin' La Vida Loca and many of the other songs on that record. So, again, Craig Lozowick, Nathan Malky, and Jules Gondar were all recording engineers on that record. And when Dan Daly asked me about it, I told him their names. Dan Daly put their names in the article. And when the editor was going through the article, for whatever reason, not to obviously slight anybody, but to simplify or clean up the article, or maybe it was too long, I don't know what, he took that out. The editor took that out. When Desmond saw the article, he was really pissed off. Desmond and I weren't working together at that time. This was later. This was about a year later. And he thought that I had taken the sole credit of that. And so Desmond wrote a letter to the editor of Mix Magazine, which they then published, that was accusing me of being a spotlight hog and to taking all the credit, and that I didn't credit Craig and Nathan and Jules. I've always felt bad that Nathan, Jules, and Craig didn't get their credit in Mix Magazine. And I'm glad Desmond wrote the letter to make sure that they got their credit. I just wanted to make sure that I said it here. I will tell you that I told this story again to Billboard magazine on the 20th anniversary. The whole story, mentioning Craig, Nathan, and Jules' names, she didn't put it in the article.
Well, we'll make sure we edit it out for you too.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Just to clean things up.
Jules, Craig, and Nathan, I am so sorry. I hope this makes it into this video.
We'll see. We'll see how it works out. Oh, mercy me.
Oh, my God.
Charles, sir, let's go ahead and give you the last word.
Well, this has been a thrill. if I have any advice, it really goes back to that Desmond advice, because I'm a teacher also, and I teach music students and producers. And it's just, if you think you are doing something that is frightening you because you think others won't like it. There's this amazing documentary that I show my students that shows Dr. Dre talking about the making of The Chronic. And he was scared to death when he was making that record that everybody was going to hate it. And in many ways, he was right, because in this exact same documentary, a few minutes later, Questlove comes on and says, yeah, I was one of those people. I hated The Chronic initially. And he said, 10 years later, I realized what Dr. Dre was doing. He was making a piece of art, and he was doing something different. So the lesson that I pass on to my students, it's the Dr. Dre lesson, because when he's explaining this, Dr. Dre's explaining it, you can tell the self-doubt that he's expressing that he felt while he was making that record. So what my advice is chase the doubt. If you feel yourself making something that you think, I don't think other people are going to like this. And the reason why you think that is because it sounds different and you're afraid. You only have to ask yourself one question. Do you love it? And if the answer to that question is yes, keep fucking doing that. Chase that doubt. You're on the right path. Mind that path. On the other hand, if you go, oh, I think everybody's going to like this because it sounds just like all that other stuff that's on there, you are definitely going the wrong direction. I promise you, you're going the wrong direction. You are making something that will not stand out and will not be noticed because it sounds like what everybody else is doing. So chase self-doubt. Dare to suck, as Desmond would say.
Dare to suck.
Dare to suck.
Now, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Charles is a true master of his craft and an inspiration to us all. So please join me in giving him a big thanks for taking the time to share his stories with us, and thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode21. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.